This is an ABC podcast.
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
Welcome to today's Conversation Hour. Beverly O'Connor has for a long time been a presence here on the airwaves and on the screens of the ABC. She was for many years a presenter on this very radio station and radio network on local radio back in the days when it was 3LO and then 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Radio right around Australia. She now hosts on ABC TV a program called The World. And it's a pleasure to welcome her back to a radio microphone.
We are one of the last surviving relics, the two of us, aren't we?
You're calling me some sort of a dinosaur.
I'm owning it because I'm including myself.
But it is Beverlysaurus Rex.
Beverlysaurus Rex. We did think back to those old days on a corner of Lonsdale and William Street.
I mean,
we had such fun, didn't we, darling?
I remember the time.
I heard you reminiscing about Paul Barber and talking to Terry Laidler recently on the radio. And we have evolved through so many different cycles. It's quite remarkable. And we are privileged to still be opening our mouths and talking.
And you haven't aged a bit.
Not a bit, no.
Look at the rest of us.
You're such a liar. That's because women dye their hair and men don't.
Oh, is that what
Although
it
some
is?
Men do and it's never a good look. Men out there, do yourselves a favour. Do not do it.
This is entirely natural.
Oh, right? I can tell.
Have you just hurt yourself? Have you just recovered from an injury?
I managed to give myself some very serious burns. I don't know about you, and in fact, I know the answer before I ask you. I'm a person who loves hot drinks. Do you?
Oh, yeah. Cups of tea.
Cups of tea. And does it matter that they sort of the heat, the temperature of the cup of tea fades as you're drinking it?
Yeah, you don't want it stone cold.
Yeah.
Lukewarm's a bit boring, but I like it, you know, fresh.
So do you reheat your tea in the microwave?
No.
Okay, so I'm a notorious. It takes me 3 hours to drink a cup of tea or a takeaway coffee.
You reheat it?
I reheat it in the microwave.
No.
So that is something I've always done. I know. And
how often do you do that?
Oh, maybe 3 or 4 times.
To the same cup?
To the same cup.
Again and again.
Again and again, so that it's always hot. Because I'll have a few sips and then my mind will go on to something else and then I'll come back and it won't be hot.
Why don't you get one of those little thermos things?
That's a solution.
The ones with a little button on the top.
Because I don't like the taste of it.
They're
metallic-y. So anyway, it was a Friday night and I have Friday nights off and I'd gone for a lovely long walk along the beach and I had this half a cup and I must say it was a takeaway cup. And I've now learned why they give you double cups when it's hot.
Uh-oh.
So I popped it in the microwave and I thought, oh, it's been a busy week. I just want to sit down here and chill for 5 seconds. Sat down on the couch, leant back a little bit, took my first sip and the cup completely collapsed on top of me and went right down my chest and into my nether regions. Not my nether regions, my middle nether regions. My boobs.
Down your front.
For once, exactly. Can I say boobs on 774?
I don't know. Can you?
Can we say boobs?
I don't know. What are you looking at them for?
Looking down. She doesn't want to know. She doesn't want to get into this conversation. It was insane.
That was
6 o'clock on 6:30 on a Friday night.
Just microwaved.
But it was. I'd obviously done a little too much microwaving.
So you scalded yourself.
Second degree burns.
Second degree.
But I didn't realize at the time, and I had gym gear on, so it just was clinging to my skin. And I was sort of jumping around thinking, whoa, this is pretty serious.
Anyone there to help you?
No one there to help. And also, interestingly enough, I've never done this kind of thing to myself. Like, I've never really had a burn.
Well, you've never poured scalding water down your front.
Scalding coffee, mind you.
Coffee and some of your more delicate parts.
Delicate parts. So then I ripped everything off, obviously, and thought, oh, my goodness, and it was just, you know, getting extremely red. So I didn't know immediately that I'd now have learned is that you immediately hop in a shower. In fact, you don't even take your clothes off. You get into a shower, cold water, and you just stand there for half an hour to an hour.
And cool it off. But you didn't do that?
I didn't do that. Sort of jumped around for a little while and then eventually went to the chemist who then gave me some stuff and sent me home to put ice on.
By which point it was too late. Did you have to go through that indignity of showing the chemist?
I did. Yeah.
Male
not,
or
not,
female?
Not, no, I did ask for a female, which only delayed it for another 5 or 10 minutes. So, no, it wasn't good. Dear. And then the next morning, I was just a mass with blisters. Yeah. Skin had already peeled off. It was a really interesting... I mean, you know, I
painful.
Guess... Painful? Painful beyond. Painful beyond. And those...
How long ago was this?
It was a couple of weeks ago.
How are you now?
Much, much better.
No, don't show me.
No. Come on, you know you want to. No, it has definitely said no to that when 774 becomes a striptease. So, look, you learn some lessons, and I mean, I guess it's an interesting one to note. It's really be super careful when you do stupid things, because the number of people that have since told me that they do exactly the same thing as me, constantly reheating their coffees and teas and whatever we like to drink. Some of us like to drink hot beverages rather than lukewarm, and also learn what you have to do. I mean, I would have mitigated what did the severity of it had I jumped in that shower immediately. So it's an interesting lesson.
Have you made a full recovery to your...
I'm slowly making full... I have parts of it. I did receive second degree burns, which just take a lot longer and sort of have to heal internally. But really, you know, other than my learnings, I'm sort of fighting fit and it's not stopping me.
Good. Good. And do you still microwave your drinks to refresh them?
I still microwave my drinks.
But not in a disposable or collapsible cup.
No, I have absolutely stopped that. And that is one of the key things, because you do, it literally collapsed. And that's something you need to understand, that it is not a stable vessel, for want of a better word. So that's, it's big learning. But anyway, you survive and you move on and it's fine. It hasn't stopped me running around.
Bev O'Connor, host of The World on ABC TV. A former member of the board of the Melbourne Football Club and former presenter on ABC Radio. And our first guest is an American comedian who straddles the Atlantic and also has a career very successfully in Ireland, appearing as a stand-up comic. Des Bishop has come to the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, but I'm not quite sure why. Des, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
You had every reason not to come, but you still have appeared.
Yeah.
Please explain.
Oh, yeah. So my mom died 9 days before the festival. And it's funny you should say you had every reason.
Our condolences.
Oh, thank you very much. Mm. It's funny you should say you had every reason not to come, because one of the jokes that so I've decided to talk about it in the show only because it was so pervasive in my mind I kind of couldn't ignore it. But one of the jokes in the show I say is, if you really want to understand Catholic guilt, you have to understand how I felt, because I felt terrible that I canceled only the first night of the Melbourne Festival because my mother had died, which is a genuine excuse. And I think the average Australian millennial would probably think, like, oh, I have anxiety today, I can't do the show. And I'm not making fun of them. I think it's great that they put their mental health first, but I actually felt terrible, which is kind of what the Irish Catholic guilt is, you know, this sense that somehow you can't let people down.
Did your mother approve of your comedic career?
Oh, absolutely, my mother approved of my comedic career.
She'd want you to have kept going?
Oh, 100%. In fact, my mother had been sick for a long time, but we weren't 100% sure that she was actually heading off. In fact, the sort of the last turn of 24 hours was quite the shock to us. But literally the week before, only 4 days before, my brother told her, oh, Des is coming back to see you, kind of a just in case. And she was like, oh, but he has shows in Galway next weekend. I mean, she was still concerned. She knew my schedule, and she was still concerned that me going to see her might get in the way of me doing the shows.
But you did get to see her.
Oh, I did. I went back, actually. It was really a just-in-case scenario. Mm-hmm. I had booked a flight. I had shows in Ireland the following weekend, and then after that was my flight to Australia. So I literally had a few days off, so I said, you know what, I'll just pop back to New York just in case. And she died on the Tuesday. Now, I know a lot of people think it's weird that I talked about it in my show, but I previously did a show about my dad when he had terminal cancer, a show called My Dad Was Nearly James Bond, and it was a very good show, and it did really well internationally, and I could not face my mother in the afterlife, because I know the first thing she would say to me was, oh, your father got a show, and I didn't get a show. So really, it was my duty to my mother to do it.
So the orphan...
The adult
Des
orphan.
Bishop.
Yes.
Yeah, the orphan,
well,
Des Bishop,
I'm an orphan, so I can understand. We're bonded by that. I mean, I would imagine it's therapeutic to a degree.
Yeah, I think number one, it's therapeutic. Number two, it's practical, because the 7 weeks leading up to the festival, where I would have been finishing off that last bit of material, I was focused on looking after my mother and bouncing back and forth from Ireland. But also, honestly, for me, I like talking about that stuff. I like finding the humor in it, because it's a very real thing.
So, whoa. Finding the humor in it, in your mother's death?
Well, the humorous parts of it, in that we're all going to grieve in our lives. Comedians talk about having children, getting married, all these things are very normal topics, but they are not guarantees. You are not guaranteed to have a child. You're not guaranteed to get married, but we are guaranteed to either die ourselves, but most likely we're going to deal with major grief in our life. And we tend to ignore it. Not that I'm considering myself the great Eastern philosopher, but we tend to ignore it. And whether people like it or not, there are some funny things that people can identify in grief, things about funerals, things about wakes. There's just funny moments. And it's actually quite it's a nice thing for an audience to hear that normalized, because then they realize, oh, I felt that too. And I thought there was something wrong with me that I found the humor in that.
And also, I think having had a similar experience as yours, having lost both parents, what you do ultimately remember is those precious moments of humor, of being having a lot of fun together. And I imagine were your parents funny themselves? Was your mother a funny woman?
My mother was very funny. My dad was funny in a kind of hammy way. My mother was funny in a very sarcastic way, you know, because she was like a tough Irish woman, my mother. I joke in the show and I say, I'm not saying my mother didn't love me. She just forgot to let me know, which, because I get a lot of Irish people on the show, they really identify with that, you know. That and that's the thing, you know, the show is really kind of a celebration of my mother's life, but it's not afraid to sort of, you know, have fun about the quirks of who she was and the generational aspect of that type of mother, you know, that sort of tough love that seems, you know, it's a different time,
and
you know?
It's what formed you. But yeah, it is what formed you.
Exactly. That's the other thing I say in the show, because, you know, I think my mother had a massive anxiety disorder, but that wasn't a term that got floated around in the 80s, so we really just thought she was like a little nuts. And I joke in the show and I say, I wish we knew about anxiety disorder, because then when I was 10, somebody would have said, oh, your mother just has a mental illness. And I would have been like, oh, great. And then I would have been well-rounded. I wouldn't be a comedian and I wouldn't be on stage trying to deal with my grief with a bunch of strangers. So I'm happy. I'd rather have had the childhood that I had. But, you know, I just in reference to, you know, you're talking about joking about your mother's death. Grief is very painful. And my show isn't about the denial of grief. It's just looking at one tiny aspect of grief and loss in a funny way. But that's only 1 hour of my day. The rest of the time you deal with the reality. And over time, because I lost my dad in 2011. Now I've lost my mom. I know that the grief process takes time. But what I like about this show is that I will never get a chance to perform in the rawness of the immediacy of my mother's death. And I guess the artist in me, which sounds a little bit, you know, pretentious, but the artist in me says, I might as well take this opportunity because it's really a one-off chance.
And had you made peace with your mother about your childhood had you in her lifetime made peace with your mother about her anxiety and not showing you love?
Absolutely. Yeah, we had a good year. I mean, all of us are sober alcoholic. Like, all of us stopped drinking. My parents and then my brothers and I in my case, late adolescence. So we've done the whole journey of therapy and looking at yourself. And I really went through the full journey with my mom, you know, and the arguments and the fights and the resentments. And I mean, I can truly say at the end that all those resentments had faded. And in fairness to my mother, you know, she really worked on herself a lot in that last period of life, because obviously she had to deal with the loss of my father, which I think it's harder to lose a spouse than to lose a parent, I believe. But I can't speak from experience. But that for her, being left alone, she really worked on herself quite a bit. And she herself admitted that she had an anxiety disorder. And she had her own regrets that it ruled her life for so long. But in the end, she battled that. And, you know, I think she died without that regret in her heart.
Death and dying is highly kind of specific to culture. You know, the way we've got three Indian comedians joining us at the moment. I mean, the way they do death in India is completely different to the way we do death here in Australia. Or, I mean, the Irish have extraordinary rituals surrounding the death. Now, you straddle both societies and cultures, half Irish, half American. So which rituals do you adopt?
Oh, well, we're very Irish. I mean, we're like Irish American, which I know is people get dismissed a bit as Irish Americans, but we were very Irish American. It was a big part of our identity growing up. And I also joke in the show, because Melbourne people also understand that, you know, the different cultures of Irish kids and Greek kids growing up together. But at my mother's wake, the Irish people, this is a genuine thing, Irish and Irish Americans, they come in and their immediate reaction is to joke around, is to make a laugh, and to they feel like they need to make people comfortable with humor. Whereas the Greeks and the Italians all came in, heads down, dressed in black, and the furthest thing from their mind was to tell a joke. And we had to kind of like bring them into the scenario of, we're just going to fool around here, okay?
We're going to
get into the grief privately when nobody's looking. You know, we're not publicly emotional. And so that there's clearly differences in cultures. I mean, I think European cultures to a certain degree are quite similar. Just maybe the way they react emotionally is a little different. But, you know, in America, we do it the Irish way. We have the wake, we have the funeral. And, you know, my mother was very Catholic, so that was very
important. Do you have the body viewing and all of that?
My mother's two. She never told me where she wanted to spread the ashes, which is actually a funny story. But the two things she's been telling me for 20 years, I want to be cremated and I want a closed casket. She was adamant. She used to say sometimes, like, Desmond, will you please, I beg of you, do not have an open casket. She did not want people looking at her. You know, I guess if she hadn't done her own makeup. I mean, she was very vain. You know,
I can totally identify with that. Yeah.
So there you go. So that was it. But anyway, I respected her wishes in every way. And we were very lucky. I mean, I'm a lapsed Catholic, but we were very lucky. The priest that we got was actually a fantastic priest. And he gave my mother, he helped us to give my mother a great send-off. He didn't do it in that traditional way. He gave a great homily, did a ton of research about my mom. So all in all, I have to say, even that was highly satisfying, despite the sadness of the occasion, that we looked after my mother to the end, and also we gave her a great send-off. So it was quite nice.
It's important, isn't it, these rituals? There's a reason why rituals are rituals.
But I think sometimes we don't, in our culture, which our cultures are very obviously similar, Scottish, Irish, Danish, whatever, Jewish.
You're South African.
Whatever. We're talking about our origins, because that's where the rituals come from.
Yeah, the
from.
Rituals
The rituals
do,
come
I
from
feel
our
they
origins.
Come from
There's
that.
Nothing. I think we lack rituals
so
here.
So pre-South Africa, your family were from?
Denmark and Scotland. But I think we have a very Vikings, yes, rape and pillagers. Rapers and pillagers. No, but we have a very stoic, and to your point, that's how you deal with it. Externally, you deal with it with cracking jokes and keeping contained. That was always what I was taught. You just keep it together. You never show emotion. But I think rituals help. You know, often covering the world news, when you go to some Muslim countries, there's this wailing and Eastern European
Mediterranean,
wailing. Yeah. Exactly. And you sometimes feel uncomfortable because it feels so over the top, but
that's
it actually
how they do.
Allows it to
I think
pass.
The rituals help. Like,
yes.
Like, when I was an altar boy as a child, people always cry when they're walking out of the church at the end. And at my father's funeral, at my mother's funeral, that's just a moment where you can't deny it. The loss is so real. Mm. But it's cathartic, isn't it? You just let it out. You know, you're in this church and that's the place where you let it out. And nobody's looking at you going, look at this sobbing mess. You know, they think
that's
like,
where you get comfort.
This is where, yeah, it's comforting to have finished the process, you know?
Congratulations then on having the emotional strength to go through with it. And Des Bishop, I hope Melbourne's been kind to you and rewarding you for your...
It's been fantastic, and I'm very appreciative to my audiences for helping me. And I think they've been entertained. I think it's a decent reciprocal relationship.
Des Bishop here for the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, even though he's now an orphan, straddling both sides of the Atlantic. And the show is called The Comments Section. He's on at the Parthenon, the Greek Centre, nightly until Sunday as part of the festival. I'm joined by three representatives of the four personnel of the Indian All-Star Comedy Showcase 2019. This has become a very popular part of the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Indeed, it is now truly international. Anubhav Pal, Kani Sirka and Naveen Richard are all here as part of the Indian All-Star Comedy Showcase. And good morning to you all.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning to you, sir.
And we're very lucky because we get not just the Indian, but now we get Malaysian, we get all sorts of people coming, not just the Americans, the Irish, and some of the more traditional sources. So give us an idea, what's the flavour of Indian stand-up comedy these days?
Oh, we all taste pretty different, man.
With cardamom seeds.
Yeah. I mean, like I know I do observational, anecdotal stuff, and that this kind of stupid stuff that happens to me can happen anywhere in the world. To be honest, I can get myself into trouble no matter where I'm traveling. So that's what I talk about.
Yeah, so Naveen's not uniquely Indian comedic flavors.
I mean, I talk about what it's like being an Indian woman. And just talk about things that I was told growing up I could not talk about. Now I can do it on a public forum in
like
front
what
of,
sort
like
of things
500.
Can
like my divorce, my sex life, my dating life, marriage, and just generally like what it's like being a modern, so you can't see my air quotes, doing air quotes right now, a modern woman in India and the choices I'm making.
Are there things you can include in your routine here that you wouldn't include back in India?
No, I've actually tried a lot of stuff in India that have been a little bit, we've received a bit of a from the audience. A lot of the time, a lot of tisking happens from the audience when I do a lot of my jokes. But yeah, let's see how it goes here.
Anubhav?
Well, I'm in many ways obsessed with what economics defines as life in the third world versus life in, I guess, what would be called here as the first world. You know, I mean, everything that you don't think about in India, we have a billion people. You know, what is, I did my first show in Geneva recently, and they had a newspaper, there's Red Alert, it said, 50,000 people have moved into Geneva, the mayor has declared an emergency. 50,000 people are in my bedroom in Mumbai. Right now. That's just my wife's side of the family. But we don't think about it. We just like sort of think, oh, yeah, 50,000 people. Or, you know, why do we speak English? You know, like the empire and its impact and how increasingly the English language is sort of a marginalized urban thing. And when you go out and do comedy in English, the audience thinks, oh, what a privileged... You know, what are his problems? He's already English speaking. Like, these are not things we think about when we're there, but these are things that strike us, you know, outside. And also how, as Indians, we look at the world. Like, I love your city. It's absolutely gorgeous. I saw the...
A bit like home much of the time here. There's so many Indians who have made Melbourne their home these days. It's extraordinary. It's fantastic.
We haven't seen many, actually.
It's or so maybe... increased the richness of the city. We had, obviously, post-World War II European migration, but now the waves of Chinese and Indian migrants have increased magnificently the offer, the cultural offer of this city.
That's
and very cosmopolitan, right? And like, for example, you have a free tram zone in Melbourne, and I was thinking... You know, as Indian people, we just talked about this earlier, thrift is very big for us. And I read before coming up that Australians are very outdoorsy people. You know, they like swimming in the English Channel, this, that. And I thought, as an Indian person, if there's a free tram zone, we'd never leave it.
Well, it depends how risk-averse you are. You can extend the free tram zone, but there's a risk involved.
Our adventure would be leaving without paying.
Now, cross-cultural comedy is something that you've also got some experience with, because Des, you've done comedy in China too.
I did a TV show where I arrived in Beijing without any Chinese, and then I had 1 year to learn enough Chinese to do stand-up comedy in Mandarin for a Chinese audience in China.
In Mandarin?
Wow. Yeah, but I mean, really, it's not a gimmick is probably the bad word, but the hook is really just a way to tell the story of modern China, which I had wanted to tell. So it was just a fun way to tell it, and you can focus on the sense of humor and the people.
Hang on, I don't think, Bev, we're not going to let him get away with this, are you?
Seriously, an Irish New Yorker deciding that he needs to tell the story of modern China.
In Mandarin, which is the notoriously most difficult
language.
It's the hardest
language in the world, and you took just a year? I mean, why so slow?
Okay. Well, if you honestly, everyone in this room, if they had the privilege of putting a year to their life aside to learn a language, you would be amazed at how fluent you would become. Oh. But
through immersion,
listening and motivation. I mean, motivation is one of the key drivers of learning a language. And if you know that the Irish people are going to watch your progress, then you're going to want to do well.
Mm. Did you have a Chinese girlfriend? Because isn't that the best way to learn a language?
That does help.
That is absolutely the best way to learn a language. And the second year, I loved it so much, I stayed a second year outside of the. Outside of the television show. And when I started going out with Xuan Xuan, my Chinese improved a lot, because you have to argue and you have to hold your ground. It's hard to do that.
Yeah.
But as you can see, you came here, you immediately observed society, you found some funny things about Melbourne, particularly from your sort of Indian point of view. And it's actually way easier than you think to take your outsider's point of view, learn about a place and turn it into humor. And the locals really appreciate your different point of view.
How I'm so fascinated in terms of how quickly this comedy has sprung up in India, because you don't see it as a major tradition, yet you've just spoken, the three of you, about very different forms.
Yeah.
How new is it?
It's less than 10 years old. Like, and we were there in the beginning, like when it was not an industry, there was nothing. We were just randomly just doing open mics and like we were organizing the open mics. Or like one,
there was one open mic in a city, and so we used to see each other all the time back. There was like five of us in each city in the beginning.
What, there was a quota?
Yeah,
that was
just only five.
what drove you at the beginning to do that? Was it the internet? Like, where were you seeing it and thought, I want to do this?
Yeah, so that's what happened. Like, we started... you know, I don't remember exactly how it came into India. I think Veer Das, one of the India's biggest comedians, he did a stand-up show once in 2000 and...
Well, I think the big motivator was in 2010, the Comedy Store of London opened the Comedy Store in
yes.
Mumbai.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I think that became
that
a big changer.
Changer.
For overseas acts.
Started initially
started,
as
yeah.
that.
So and then we have like one Indian doing a spot.
So like cricket, it caught on.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so then now that was like the pinnacle exactly. of everybody in other cities wanted to work their way up to that store. And they had auditions and stuff. So we'd start practicing our acts in our cities in Bangalore. I was from Bangalore. So I would start practicing my act there. And we were all like, oh, who can make it there fastest to that comedy store?
So what made Indian people laugh? I mean, I'm sure in every culture people laugh. But if there wasn't an organized comedic scene, what was it that got people laughing together?
The YouTube. That's what really changed the game for us. Like people started putting comedy up, like not even just stand-up, but even like sketch comedy up on YouTube. And that's when audiences started realizing that there's something here. And so that would sell, because we'd be putting out on YouTube, like we would like build audiences who would come for our live shows.
Sure, that's but Bollywood makes more films than Hollywood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bollywood makes dancing, singing, rom-com kind of things.
And quirky fun. There's a bit of corny
comedy. But didn't it make
comedy
comedies? Weren't there comedic Bollywood films?
They do. And it's a very different kind of humor. It's a lot of sort of like Italian comedia dell'arte, like, wah, 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 you know, like
slapping,
music.
Yeah. Slapstick.
Just regressive cross-dressing jokes, you know, like that kind of stuff.
And we would make fun of that in stand-up.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? So stand-up was like, okay, you're tired of Bollywood, we would make fun of Bollywood in stand-up. So in the first few years of stand-up, you had to do the most relatable thing that everybody, and that's politics, and stand-up is what everybody would talk about. Oh, sorry, politics and Bollywood. And then it started becoming more subtle
nuanced,
and like, you know, nuanced, like observational comedy. You know when you open a fridge in your house, that kind of thing.
Anecdotal comedy. Yeah.
But what was very fascinating is that the Comedy Store of London left. I mean, they opened the store and they created this movement and left. And I often compare it to the real British Empire. Because they came, they started this bludgeoning movement, but comedy survived in India, exploded through YouTube in many different languages. English comedy is now a fraction.
Yeah.
British comedians stopped coming, which is not that nice because cultural exchange is always brilliant, but economics didn't allow for it. But suddenly, comedy in India became a massive thing in its own. And just like the actual history of the country, comedy kind of followed it. So now comedy is its own Indian thing.
And is it mostly English language comedy?
No.
English is a fraction.
It used to be. Originally, it was only English because we had adopted this Western form of comedy. I mean, comedy obviously existed in India before us, but this Western form of stand-up and improv and sketch, it was predominantly English. And over the last 2 years, it's become
the
very
Hindi. The last
years
it's spread up and it's just very regional. It's not just Hindi. You know?
So explain to us, remind us how many languages that are spoken across India.
Oh yeah, we take that for granted.
Yeah, there's languages and then dialects.
Last recorded, spoken, right, because not going to Sanskrit and stuff, like that is about 4,000.
Oh my God.
Oh man.
You wouldn't have 4,000 thriving comedic circles. So,
no.
I would imagine with such a huge country that you can thrive in Bangalore and people don't even know you in Mumbai.
Oh right. Yeah, I know guys who, like, I started with a friend and we both started doing English and then he broke away and he started doing it in Tamil, which is like a southern regional language. And he sells out shows, he could sell out tickets of 2 months ahead, but nobody in Bombay knows about him. You know, he could do a show in Bombay and sell out, but the rest of Bombay doesn't know about him because just that region of people go and watch him in Bombay.
Because just Tamil Nadu is 150 million people. You know, that's Western
we
Europe.
We would kill for an audience.
But hang on, guys, do you guys know how many comedians, how many active comedians are there in India? I feel like there aren't more than 500 in the whole of India. Is that true?
So on the global comedic,
you guys are killing it.
On the global comedic per head of population scale, you know, you often see these.
Everyone in Ireland is a comedian.
I've made a very lucrative living from performing to 5 million people in the whole country of Ireland.
So are you guys jealous right now?
Yeah, I want to see your tax returns.
But also
you're heading to India.
I have a story about that too, but we'll save it for another time.
We need a history of India told in Hindi by someone from Dublin.
I pitched it. So what happened was when I made my China project, it took me 5 years to get the money. And in my frustration, about 3 years into my pitching, I went to a British company and I said, this idea about learning Mandarin. And he said, well, you know, what about Hindi or yeah. you know, one of the big communities in the UK. So I actually did pitch the Indian version, but it didn't get picked up. But now that I've met you guys, I think we should talk after this.
Yeah, definitely. You might need an Indian girlfriend. That's the next thing that'll help you. Don't lie, your current girlfriend. Kaniza, just
Priyanka Chopra would be nice. She just got married.
Kaniza, yeah. I'm fascinated. Covering world news, one of the biggest topics is the way women are treated in India. Just let's put that on the table. Yeah. There's loads of patriarchal systemic issues within India.
Well, outright violence.
Violence, rape, mm-hmm. horrible, and misogyny towards women. Mm. What sort of impact do you think comedy can have, and how have you found? You've talking about your divorce, talking about your sex life, your dating life, which would be very commonplace potentially here, but how tough is that, and can comedy help?
So, yeah, I feel like the society there is deeply misogynistic, and I know that might not go down well, but it is. And you see that in and we get immediate feedback on YouTube videos, and so when we put out videos, you'll just see the comments are just really vile when it comes to female comedians, as opposed to I didn't like it. They're just you're not funny, get out of here, you're a whore, just one after the other. I'm just what is even happening? And I think people they don't like that. A lot of men don't. I always get this feedback of why are you always talking about women issues? And I'm like, well, that's that's what
I am a woman.
I'm a woman. What else do you want me to talk about? I want to talk about these things, And it's sometimes it's a little bit scary when I go out, when I'm putting my stuff out there, because I will get some kind of retaliation.
Mm. Do you get threats?
No, I haven't gotten any threats. Not with the kind of content I do. It's just you're a whore.
Oh, yeah. So it's abuse and trolling.
It's abuse and trolling.
Well, that happens here too, and it's one of the more ghastly aspects of new media that people hide behind the cowardly cloak of anonymity.
Exactly.
To say things and do things that they would never be prepared to do if they had to put their names to it.
They'd never say that to my face. No. You'd never say it to anyone.
And what responsibility – what do you think society is taking responsibility for this issue in India, and particularly, I guess, the men as well have to come in and play their part?
I mean, sometimes my observation has been it's also physically unsafe. I played a festival in Delhi, and there was 50-50, men, women, and it was very important for the organizers to just make sure that the women on the bill were in the first half. Because post 11 o'clock at night in Delhi, transportation. So it's physically unsafe, even with a trusted paying audience of
but be honest,
urban people.
In Mumbai, that's not the case. I feel very safe in Mumbai. And I'm originally from South Africa.
Oh.
So, yeah. I know what it feels like to be unsafe. South Africa, you can't leave your house after 8 in a lot of the cities. So in Mumbai, I feel very safe. Delhi is another story, but Mumbai, I can take a cab. I can perform till 2 a.m. and I'll still be fine after that.
It's catching up in the cities, man, as it is here. I'm sure Melbourne's a lot more woke than, maybe a smaller town somewhere else, I guess. And it's kind of like that in India as well. Mumbai is... Everyone in Mumbai knew about the Me Too movement there. But I don't know if a neighboring smaller town even knew. It's stuff still happening there. It hasn't... It's basically, if you're on the internet, you know... How it's growing and all of that. But if you're not, if you're just watching regular TV, you're just going to see the sensationalized version of it. You don't really know what the values of this movement are.
Mm. And just to add to your point, I think that as urbanized, anglicized people, city comedians, which we tend to be, we're addressing only maybe 1% of the issues that are affecting, I have lots of friends who are in journalism, and the stories they tell me from what's actually going on in small towns, about people getting married very young. You would think that a country there where the internet is exploding, progressive values would explode along with it, but it's not.
Not happening.
Mm. Yeah.
The issues also, these are international. It's an international comedy festival. And I remarked before, we now have, Phil Wang was here the other day. He's from Singapore. We've got people from all over the world now coming and sharing. So, does an Indian showcase that comes to Melbourne then get picked up and sent off, say, to Montreal or somewhere else as well? And likewise, do we pick up a whole gaggle of Irish-American comedians and maybe we should have an Irish showcase? We should have, specific little kind of festivals within festivals almost that show us the very best of what's on offer all around the world.
I mean, there tends to be those types of package shows. That's not a new thing. I guess the newer thing is that there's enough comedy in the countries in Asia that suddenly you have the best of Malaysian or the best of, India or whatever. That's become a thing over the last number of years. But that's actually just good marketing, because if you have What kind of audiences are you expecting? Are you expecting a kind of a mix?
Mix.
Or are you thinking that you're going to get a lot of the expat community?
We do, by the way, we do this within India itself. You think there's a best of India here? In Bombay, we have a best of South India, something like that. Best of, and then there's South Indians versus North Indians. That's the kind
that's
of show.
Yeah, that's a whole rivalry.
It's like, we, like the cricket league, the IPL.
Yeah. It's just marketing. Honestly, it's just marketing. Yeah. And over here, we're expecting...
I'm expecting a mix.
Yeah, I think it's going
to
be mixed.
You know, it's really funny. I met a friend, random, not involved in comedy, and I met her on the streets in Melbourne, and she was like, her friend of hers actually recommended that she goes watch a show with many comedians. Like so that if she doesn't like one of them, like hopefully she'll like another one. Like she's not stuck with one person for the whole night.
Does your package for Melbourne also then go on, for instance, to the Montreal or Edinburgh festivals as well?
As a group?
No.
I think individually though we've played I did Edinburgh and then I'm coming here, and I know Kinesis has played New York and you play New York and so. But what is fascinating about festivals that I love is that you could tell a very specific local story about being from Calcutta and your father-in-law being a certain way. And someone from Sweden is losing it in the front row. And I love that. I love that. You know, I think that we talk about a billion people in comedy, et cetera, in India. It's great. But I think the art form can suffer because you can make a local politician reference and everyone would lose it, right? Yeah. But what's great is when, you know, you're an Indian comedian and you go to Lithuania. And there's a Lithuanian family going, yes, my dad is exactly like that. You know, I feel that.
So it's universal.
Yeah, I love that stuff, I think.
But it's also nice when you guys tell stories in a different way, stories about India, that you can make funny, but they're also informative. Like things that I would never know about India, now I know, and I've also been entertained by it. That's like an enriching thing for an audience to experience.
So, Des, do you do a Chinese comedy routine here for the Chinese speakers?
The only full show in Chinese I did outside of China was in New York and one in New Zealand. I haven't done one here in Melbourne. It's actually very difficult to market the Chinese language stand-up to the Chinese community here. I'll give you the example. Storm Shu is a comedian that I knew from China, but he's here at the festival, and he sells a lot more tickets for his show in English than he does in Chinese, despite the fact that he's a local Shanghai comedian that's here. So it's actually quite hard to market the comedy. I don't know about in the Indian community, because you've had more – well, I mean, I don't want to use Russell Peters and offend you guys, but you've had more people that have blown up and said, this is stand-up, and this is stand-up that India people can laugh at. China doesn't really have that yet. It's an emerging thing, but they don't have that hero that everyone goes, oh, this is a thing that happens. So it's actually quite tough to market it.
It's inevitable though, isn't it?
Yes, except the growing middle class.
Do you think it might have happened already? There's control at the moment. There's this. Xi Jinping has been cracking down on so much of the cultural diversity that I noticed in Beijing when I first visited, and now our correspondents tell us is just these little venues are shutting down bars, music.
Sure, but
art.
This is Melbourne. There's hundreds of thousands now of.
No, yeah, but I guess what I mean is they're not overly familiar with the form, so they don't. Yeah. When they see the advertisement for it, they don't go, "Oh, we need to go to that." And they actually kind of go, what is that? And they're not going to pay $25.
So the tradition hasn't established itself.
It hasn't, no.
Absolutely fascinating, though. And look, you could do, you know, bilingual comedy, which would be the other thing, and then half the audience are laughing at some things and not quite sure the other half.
I've done that with Ronnie Chang. Myself and Ronnie did a bilingual show in New York, and it was a major success.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we're going to be doing a bit of that. Some of our sets have a little bit of Hindi and English mixed. I want to try some of it and see how it lands.
You look at the Jewish comedy tradition with Yiddish, and people, you know, Yiddish kind of major terms are integrated. They became integrated into the comedy scene so much that people all learned. You know, they learned what a schmuck was or whatever.
Oh, yeah. Well, they didn't just learn it. They became a normal term.
Yeah. I thought you said they became schmucks.
I know plenty of schmucks.
Anubhav Pal, Kaniz Sirka and Naveen Richard are part of the Indian All-Star Comedy Showcase. In fact, they're three quarters of it. The Indian All-Star Comedy Showcase 2019. Tomorrow night until Sunday, three nights only at the Forum, Saturday at 5:30, otherwise later. But have a look through and book through the Comedy Festival website for the Melbourne International Comedy Festival. Des Bishop is at the Greek Centre Parthenon for the comments section nightly until Sunday. And Bev O'Connor is peddling her wares here when she's not scalding herself with reheated
my
coffee.
Wares. There you go again. No wonder you've been reprimanded all morning.
At the ABC. Hosting The World on ABC TV weeknights at 10 o'clock. Bev, Des, Anubhav, Kaniz, Naveen, thank you all for coming.
On ABC Radio, This is The Conversation Hour.